Hello and welcome to the Principal Liner Notes podcast. This is Sean Gaylord, and I am excited to have a connected conversation with a new friend, a new bandmate. We are connected by a previous guest who's been on the podcast, Jen Rafferty. I am so proud to welcome Dr. Matt Zakreski, also known as Dr. Matt. Matt is also the founder and lead clinician of the Neurodiversity Collective, but most importantly, Dr. Matt and I have a couple of things in common. One of them being that Matt is a proud Demon Deacon, a proud undergrad of Wake Forest University, which is located here in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where I grew up. So, Dr. Matt, welcome to the podcast, my friend.
Thank you for being here and for having me and for and go Deeks. I mean, it's really like we were talking about just the kinds of connections that can exist between people who otherwise would probably never have met, and just how fascinating that in this giant blue spinning marble, here we are with plenty of stuff in common. So I just think that's awesome.
No, I do too, man. And there's maybe not 6 degrees of separation, right? It may be 3 degrees of separation. So, thinking about your undergrad days at Wake and what downtown Winston-Salem was at the time, which wasn't much, and it has since grown and blossomed. So we, you and I literally have probably walked on the same streets. Been in the same places. I'm glad, I'm glad we don't, this is our first time, because who knows, we may have been mortal enemies, in a road rage incident on I-40, or on Hawthorne Road. There may have been a barroom fight someplace on Burke Street that we were a part of and didn't know it. So, but here we are together.
Yeah, as long as you didn't go to Duke, I think we'll be all right. So
No, I didn't go to Duke, so I we won't go there. We don't, but we don't want to open up that wound. So, one of the things in your work that I'm really fascinated with, as I shared with you, is this notion of playing on strengths, the strengths-based approach. I know just a little bit. To be dangerous. And I know that you've looked at it through a clinical lens and a neurological lens in your work. But I would just love to kind of, like, let's start there, if you will, and would love to kind of hear your journey into that work and what led you into that being part of your core and your role.
Well, so to me, early in my career as a psychologist, you leave grad school with your head full of these things that are best practices and how to do CBT by the manual and all that stuff. And the more I spent time with kids, especially neurodivergent kids, the more I was struck by this idea that it can be the best theory in the world, but if it doesn't land with a kid, if it doesn't anchor into meaningful change, then how useful is it really, right? So to me, sort of pivoting into a world where we are allowing kids to lead with their strengths and play to their interests. I mean, not only to me is it logical, but it's something that works and something that any teacher, any administrator can do, right? It doesn't require some fancy training or another master's degree, right? It's the idea of, we want to think about the things that we're seeing working and just turn up the volume on that, right? I grew up as one of those kids. I drew cartoons on any piece of paper that wasn't nailed down, right? I mean, I filled every piece of paper with doodles. And the teachers who saw that would allow me to play to those strengths. Like instead of writing a 20-page history paper, draw a 40-page graphic novel about the Industrial Revolution. And I was like, heck yes, let's do it, right? And so it's just one of those things where everybody does better when they're able to play to their strengths. So instead of working really hard to get kids to a place where they can start doing a thing they don't actually want to do, less hard and adapt the thing we want them to do through the lens of their interests, all of a sudden we've got more energy to do more other stuff, and we can hold that kid to a high standard through the lens of their interest.
Absolutely. And I think what that also engenders is psychological safety. And you know, which is you know kind of a somewhat of a buzzword, and if we're echoing Amy Edmondson's work and those things, but still, you know, thinking about that in an educational setting, you know, I think about you know somebody like me that struggles with that struggled with math, and the lights didn't come on for me in math until my ninth grade algebra teacher at Bishop McGinnis, Sister Rose Albert, you know, said to me, you know, because I remember I said something to her like, you know, algebra, I'm not going to use it. It's not going to help me. I'm an English person. I'm a reader. And she says, well, you're right. You're absolutely right. It's not going to help you balance a checkbook. It's not going to help you write an essay, but it is going to help you how to think, and don't. You know, mathematical is thinking, and we all need help in thinking. And I remember that kind of statement created this sense of psychological safety and warmth for me. Now, I still bombed in algebra, but I still went down in flames, but I had a little bit of an appreciation, you know, for it, and it helped me survive a little bit better.
Well, you know, you hear this all the time. It's like we're mo educators are moving from the sage on the stage to the guide on the side,
Right.
right? Sounds like Sister Rose Albert sort of repositioned herself as a guide for you. Like, listen, I'm going to be real with you. This is a thing that's going to help you in this particular way. We're not going to sit here and pretend you're going to win the Fields Medal in 20 years,
Yeah.
right? I think increasingly what kids are craving is authenticity, right? We live in a world where there's a lot of fake news, Instagram filters, TikTok trends, deep fakes, AI, blah, 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 blah. But there's a lot of fake out there. But the one thing that is irreplaceable is sitting in a space with another human being and saying, I got you, or here's the truth. And you know, one of the things I get to say all the time as a therapist is I never lie in the therapy space. That might mean I'm going to ruffle your feathers. That might mean I'm going to tell you something you don't want to hear. But if I establish that as a place of truth, it also allows me to praise kids authentically and to sort of position myself as somebody who isn't going to blow smoke up their butt, right? Like, you know, it's like, yeah, you got 85s on this test in this class because you didn't work that hard, and that's fine. But the life you want is not accessible to you if you only do fine. The life you want, the Ivy League, the cool job, the hedge fund, they don't take fine. They take awesome. So you tell me what you want to do, right? And that's, you know, that's that kind of authenticity, that realness that people are craving.
You know, and this kind of echoes a little bit of our mutual friend Jen Rafferty, and the work that she does for educators. And you know, one of the things that Jen and I have talked about is how teachers and administrators are not okay right now. That there is, you know, a crisis, if you will. A mental health crisis that's going on, you know, globally, and our educators are have been through it, you know, pre and post pandemic. So prior to the pandemic, you know, COVID didn't create this, but prior to, and I'd speak as somebody 32 years in education, you know, teaching education has just been under an attack in any way, shape, or form, and we put all of our resources and heart and soul into getting through remote learning and COVID and the pandemic, and you know for about 2 weeks everybody was loving on teachers, and then that kind
Heroes, frontline employees, right?
yeah exactly and then that quickly ended. So for the teacher or administrator that is struggling right now, and is grappling this, and they're hearing this, and they're going, "Yeah, that's great, Dr. Matt. Sure, praise, but I've got, 32 kids in my classroom. I've got to get test scores up. The principal that's listening to this right now. I've got a superintendent or a school board or a community that has me in a vice grip right now because the report card grade is this way, or I'm dealing with this issue right now, and right now all I can do is manage just getting through the day or getting through the next crisis or putting out the next fire." So how does one kind of lean into or gradually tune into a strengths-based approach, whether it's from a classroom perspective or whether it's from a school leadership perspective?
The great news is that they go hat in hand, right? Doing one better amplifies the other, right? So the first thing we're going to do here is we're going to stop doing what I like to call Wile E. Coyote-ing, right? Remember those old Looney Tunes cartoons where Wile E. Coyote would run
Isn't
off
it
the...
the Roadrunner?
Oh, yeah. And then he would be, 300 feet into a chasm and he'd be fine until he looked down and he'd plummet, right? We've all Wile E. Coyote'd the last 5 years, right? I mean, it has been an onslaught of bad news, awful headlines, world crises. I mean, it's exhausting, right? And the only way to get ourselves into a sustainable situation is to acknowledge how hard it is, right? And one of the most powerful things saying to anybody is, I don't have the solution to this, but I am here with you in it, right? We may not know how to get out of this mess, but at least we're walking together, right? That's that authenticity. We don't want toxic positivity. I mean, because I don't, I could, I mean, I easily say to you, Sean, I'm like, ah, oh, buy my book, right? Or take this pill, or sign up for my $5,000 masterclass. I mean, those things might move the needle, but it's not curative. Right. So we're going to move to things that are therapeutic in nature, not therapy. Right. So the thing is that all of this stuff is actually drastically supported by the research. Right. The research of bringing fun into learning actually has kids learn more, retain it longer, and engage more. Giving kids more breaks promotes retention, promotes engagement, lowers behavioral challenges. Right. I was at a observing in kindergarten last year here in New Jersey, and this teacher who was screaming at this little girl to keep her feet on the floor, her legs were not long enough for her to sit with her butt on the chair and her feet on the floor. And I never do this, but I pulled her aside. I was like, you are asking this kid to do something they can't do, and you are choosing to go 10 rounds with this little girl about a thing that's impossible. So either have her bat on the chair, or have her sit crisscross applesauce, right? Because this is absurd. And it's the sort of thing, like, we're all under so much pressure. And when we're under pressure, it's human nature to double down on hard work, right? And a lot of us are like, if I just work harder, if I just skip dinner, if I just don't sleep, if I just take on an extra job, everything will be okay. And the solution to all these things is almost always do less. It's work smarter, not harder, right? If you take one class a day that is just draining you and say, guys, this class isn't working for us and not working for any of us, right? How can we redo this class where we all get our jobs done, right? First off, you're treating the kids like they matter, right? You are showing them, hey, your opinions matter. Secondly, you're working smarter, not harder. You are trying to jam a square peg through a round hole. Instead, it's like, let's think about all the shapes and all the holes we have available to us. One of the things that I tell teachers all the time is this is Carol Ann Tomlinson's work. Any teacher can adapt how the content that's being taught, the process of through which it's taught, and the way we assess it. One simple thing any educator can do, And from a principal's perspective, from an admin perspective, empower your teachers to change how they assess the learning. Let kids opt into, I want to take a chapter test, I want to write a 3-page paper, or I want to do a 20-slide PowerPoint presentation. That simple shift, what you're doing is kids are opting into things that they feel more comfortable with, which means they're more likely to study, which means they're less likely to fight you, which means they're more likely to get better grades, right? So you make the parents happy, the teachers happy, the kids happy, and then that means fewer people are screaming at you as the admin. I mean, how often in life do we find a win-win-win-win? That's the dream, right? So those simple shifts, right? You know, it's the sort of thing like, you know, I have young children. Like getting into a power struggle with a child never wins, right? So either you win and you feel like a jerk, or you lose and you feel worse because you lost to a child. The answer is almost always stop, reset, take a breath. Let's approach this from a different solution, a different direction, and you're going to see better outcomes.
Powerful. You know, in addition to, and I greatly appreciate the Wile E. Coyote reference, by the way. I'm just having some childhood flashbacks right now, you know, to enjoying the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner hour. Is you're unique, you have a unique perspective on things that not only is in the educational space, but also in the corporate space. And one of my things as a school leader is I always try to find some entry point or bridge into quote the quote unquote corporate world or real world to kind of either legitimize what we do or in the schoolhouse or to find ways that we can connect you know teachers and kids. So I'm just curious. What trends or what issues or what things do you see in the corporate world in your work as a psychologist and in the work that you do with neurodiversity?
I think that part of strengths-based learning so is applied to the workplace as well. You know, one of my favorite exercises to do with people is you know, room full of people. It's like, all right, let's plan a party. Let's plan a party together, right? You know, so Sean, we're going to plan a party. What do you want to do to make this party happen?
We're gonna figure out who we're gonna invite to the party, you know, and
Right. So you're gonna, do you want to be in charge of the guest list?
not really, I'll do the music.
Ah, see, and all it took was one question to move you off the thing that you thought was the right answer to the thing you actually want to do, right? And that's education. That's also business, right? It's like, ah, I want to do this thing for you, boss. Do you really want to do this thing for me? No, I do not. Right? I do not want to go to this conference. I don't want to go to this meeting. I don't want to do a 6-hour seminar on active listening. Right. So when you put people in a position to plan a theme party, they eventually opt into the things that they want to do, the things that are naturally aligned to their skills and interests. Right. And which means you're moving them towards the things they want to do and away from the things that are going to drag them down. Like you want me to make the drinks or greet people at the door or plan a menu. You don't want me taking money. I'm bad with money. You don't want me to be in charge of that. I will just be like, that's too hard. Just everybody come in for free, right? You don't want me to book the venue. I'm not that guy, right? But I'll help you with a guest list. And what you see is when you allow people to play to their strengths, they naturally cluster. All the people who want to be in the kitchen are going to be in the kitchen. All the people who are going to make drinks are going to be making drinks. And the people who just want to drop off paper towels and leave, they're going to know who they are too. But somehow we've fallen into a work and school paradigm that it's like, what I need you to do is X. And I know it's your skills are A, B, C, and D, but I need you to do X. Why are we having the conversations that way? Why, it's backwards, right? What we really want to do is, you know, if you talk to a kid who walks through the door, it's like, what do you want to be? You know, I want to be a plumber. Well, then you know what? We're going to emphasize learning with your hands. We're going to emphasize project-based learning. And I'm going to de-emphasize you reading Wind in the Willows because I have a feeling that's not moving the needle for you. And it can, hold on a second. Why are you honoring who I want to be? because you're the person that matters, right? Parenting, teaching, and being a boss, a leader, and a CEO, they need to be egoless jobs. It's not about us. It's about the people we serve. And the most effective organizations are the people with leaders who get that. Who it's like, the more I amplify you, that becomes a rising tide that lifts all boats.
Wow. That it you know, and you frame it in such a practical, accessible way. And I and forgive me, you know, for those who may not be familiar with the term neurodiversity, you know, and that is part of your moniker and in your work. What would be kind of a running definition or running understanding of what is meant by neurodiversity for those who may not be familiar with that term?
So neurodivergence is people with different brains. So that's gifted, ADHD, autistic, dyslexic. You know, these are things that aren't just mental health challenges. They are literally different brains.
Mm-hmm.
And about 1 in 5 people are neurodivergent, which means every teacher, every administrator, every coach, every librarian is dealing with these kids. This is not just special ed, it's everybody.
Right.
Neurodiversity is all the brains, right? So you can be neurodivergent or neurotypical. And then all of that is under the umbrella of neurodiversity. So just like any school organization is a diverse organization, right? You've got kids of these colors and these socioeconomic backgrounds and these sexual orientations and these religions, right? Et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
We're a diverse space. We are fundamentally a diverse people. And we all benefit when we lean into that diversity. We don't run from it, right? Mm-hmm. And instead of creating 1,319 different systems for 1,319 different kids, what we do is we create systems that are inherently flexible and adaptable, that we can meet things and shift into the things that different kids need to be successful.
Wow. Thanks for that. I appreciate that, that kind of running definition, Matt, you know, and you've seen this, I know you work with different folks, but what is a common pitfall that you see once folks wrap their heads around the strengths-based approach and best of intentions and they sat through either your TED talk or a keynote or they contract with you or work with you? What is a common pitfall that you see that folks in my realm, in the K-12 realm, need to avoid or at least be cognizant of in approaching this?
So you sort of stole my talking point, because to me it all starts with education, right?
Yeah.
I always ground my talks in neuroscience, because it's like, listen, you still hear people who are like, ADHD is just bad parenting. It's too much sugar. It's TikTok. It's not. It's literally a brain difference. If I can show you a slide, it's like, here's what an ADHD brain looks like. Here's what a neurotypical brain looks like. You can literally see the difference,
mm-hmm.
right? If we understand where this stuff is coming from, it increases our awareness, which increases our empathy. So, you know, so step one, we educate everybody. Step two, what we're going to do is we're going to understand that our job as anybody who serves kids, from the mental health side to the education side to the medical side, we are all in the business of promoting resiliency. We want to build resilient kids.
Mm-hmm.
And what the research shows is kids build resiliency more naturally, with a longer lasting outcome through strengths-based education than they do just by working hard, right? So what we said before, like, work smart, not hard.
Right.
So you'll talk to Sue like, well, this kid needs to do 500 or, you know, multiplication problems to learn math. That's grit. That's hard work. It is absolutely hard work, and you are burning that kid out, right? It is not there, you know, those kids aren't meant to learn that way. That kid who can do 7 problems and show you mastery and then move on to the next thing, that's a kid who's building resiliency, right? We're not saying don't do it. We're saying do it smart. right? And what we end up doing is when we're stressed or overwhelmed, we just double down on the old ways, right? Read 300 pages in a book in a night, do 500 math problems, copy down all these sentences off the board. That's not meaningful engagement, right? Resiliency is built best through meaningful engagement. You'll get a kid who will learn more resiliency in 30 minutes of a Minecraft raid than they would in 3 months of reading Tom Sawyer if they don't care about Tom Sawyer, right? So it's the sort of thing, like, the brilliant stuff about all this is that kids communicate through their backpacks, through their interests, through the things they share, the things they talk about, what they're interested in, right? So they're opening the door for us. We just have to walk through it, right? Because all the stuff we want them to learn and the skills we want them to master are on the other side of that door. So if you can talk to a kid about all what they did in Minecraft and amplify all the resilience they've already built, we don't even have to have them do anything new. We're just giving them more credit for the stuff that's already been done. It's like finding 20 bucks in your jeans. You always had the $20, but then you're like, oh man, $20 in my jeans, right? Now it's like found money, right? So you can say to a kid, hey, you know what? It's pretty amazing that you did a whole day of school. You went to soccer practice for 3 hours, came home, did your math homework, came in and got a 93 on that quiz. That is freaking impressive, dude. We have not said a single thing that kid didn't actually do, but we changed the narrative in a way that amplified the best things about that kid's story.
I love that. Which in turn impacts culture,
yep.
which in turn increases morale, so to speak, not only for the student, but for the teacher who is trying to generate a result or generate an effect or generate an impact, whatever that may be. And I can, and then when you have morale, it's more productive, but it spirals into good and great things.
Yeah. And, in what you said is like, we are so many vicious cycles in education, right? Parents complain at the school board meeting, which makes the teachers defensive and reactive, which empowers those crazy parents to keep yelling at us, which makes us shrink further. It's a vicious cycle. When we can find a virtuous cycle, what you find is when kids feel better, they do better. When they do better, they act better. When they act better, they feel better. Then they do better. Then they feel better. Then they act better. And around and around and around.
Mm-hmm.
One of the teachers that I work with, up in Connecticut, she took a hint from me on one of the kids we both serve. I'm like, listen, just do me a favor with this kid. Let this kid find a story about the thing you're talking about and then write a book report about that thing. And that kid will never bother you again. And because he's got pretty significant social anxiety, has a tough time speaking out in class. So she's like, well, how is he going to find a book about the American Revolution that isn't something we've done to death? I'm like, but that's the ownership piece. And he can go find the book, right? So he's finding books on it and he's writing great research papers, book reports. The teacher's like, he is mastering content. I'm not making him do stuff he hates, which was causing behavior problems that were draining them both, right? This isn't like, oh, don't do the work. It's do the work smarter, right? Just like the theme party. I could arbitrarily decide that you have to mop up afterwards. And if that's not your skill set, you're less excited, less willing to engage, and I've got to work harder to get you to do the thing. I mean, who loses in a situation where we're letting people play to their strengths?
That's it. We see it in sports.
Mm-hmm.
We see it in music. I mean, we see it in how, in different corporate settings, if we're recruiting, hey, we need, or if we're building a team, we need the best accountant possible for this, or we need the best forensic psychologist or whatever it may be. So it's just really good common sense in some ways, but then also the rewards to me in the long run are just, it's a win-win. In thinking about the educator and school leader that's tuning in, Matt, what's a good first achievable step next for a strengths-based approach? What would you recommend? The person that's listening right now that's thinking, and depending on where they are in whatever part of the world, here in America, we're getting ready to go back to school in a few weeks.
Very soon, yeah.
Very soon. And this is, for me as a leader, principal, hey, it's a clean slate. I don't want to mess anything up. It's a new beginning. So there's that kind of vibe that's going on right now. I would hope. Others, there may be a sense of dread, but what's a good next step for this?
So a good next step is to talk to your kids, right? And so you can send a letter home, you can send an email, you can do a Google form for all I care, right? But say this year at XYZ school, we want to put the students first. Research shows that when you put students' interests first, they learn better, they learn it longer, and they do better on tests, which, and all of that is true. I can send you the studies. So tell me, what did you spend your summer doing? What do you do with your free time? What are the books you like to read, the Netflix shows you want to watch? What's your favorite YouTube channel? What's your, what are the games you like to play? The more data we get on that stuff, right? We create sort of a mental dossier of that kid. Because if we know Sally is super into Monster High and rereads the Twilight books, obsessively. Well, I'm going to point her towards more like Bram Stoker, Mary Shelley,
Right.
right? If I know Carlos is super interested in Formula One racing and builds Legos in his spare time, well, that's more of a PBL kid, right? That's a kid I want to sell. Dude, we're going to bring back Auto Shop for you, right? Get under the hood, figure out how that intake valve works, right? And it's the sort of thing, it doesn't need to be all the time,
Right.
right? What the research shows is it has to be about 30% of the time. So you figure 5 day school week, 30% is about a day and a half. So which means you need to do 1 to 2 days a week of this interest-based learning. You lock the kids in, they're more engaged, you have to spend less time managing expectations and behavior. They feel better, they do better. So get the information so you've got that data. Right. And then all that stuff will flow. And if you get good information from it, send the survey out again around Thanksgiving and send it out again around spring break. Because kids evolve quickly. Right. So, Digimon, I'm not into Digimon. That was Thursday. I'm a Pokemon guy now. Oh, yeah. Right.
That's awesome. To shift gears just a little bit, I know before we hit record, when in our conversation about degrees of separation and common ground, you cited a little bit of fandom for Trampled by Turtles. And I know also, in addition to that being one of your bands and you're in the fan club, I also know that you have a propensity for Broadway. And I do as well. I love a good show tune. And in another life, I've played in different bands and things and played a few things. But I'm curious, you and I are in the plane. The plane's crashing, and you're getting ready, and we're jumping out. And I'm like, "Come on, Dr. Matt, we got to go." And you're like, "No, I got to grab the soundtrack to this musical. What is it?"
Oh man, it's so cliche, but I've got to say it. Rent, because Rent was the show when I fell in love with musical theater. There was no arts in my town growing up. I went to high school and they were like, "Hey, musical theater is a thing." I was like, "I don't even know what that is, but it's a damn sight better than being the last guy on the team on basketball." And so Rent was the first show I fell in love with. So I would be grabbing the dual CD for those who don't remember, were these little discs. They did not work very well. And I would, leap out of the plane screaming La Vie Bohème in my head. That's
Oh, wow. Wow. That's quite an image. One of my daughters, who is a Broadway aficionado, Rent is one of her all-time favorite shows, and she, yeah, that gets quite a lot of airplay here when she's home. So,
I'm sure. I'm
yeah,
sure.
I have all the feels for that show and that story. So that's powerful. All right, so, as you're jumping out, I'm out of this airplane. You got Rent, I got room in the knapsack for another disc. Which other Broadway show you want me to grab?
I mean, is it too much to ask for, is it too much to ask for Wicked?
Okay, not at all. Not at all. Not at all. Not at all.
Because we're talking about air, defying gravity. It's kind of, it's a little on the nose, but I think
Well, maybe we'll elevate as we sing that together and fly and defy gravity. Dr. Matt, I am so grateful for you and grateful for your time. And I've learned so much today on the podcast. So you've got an open invitation to come back, and we'll do a special Broadway edition of the podcast, my friend.
That count me in for that. That would be awesome.
As we sign off here, again, I will put all of Dr. Matt's information in the show notes. Dr. Matt Zakreski, thank you again. This is Sean Gaylord signing off. Don't forget to share with the world your dreams, your ideas, because the world needs them, and you help make the world a better place. This is the Principal Liner Notes podcast. Thanks for tuning in.